Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM. It's time now for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The cost of college education is skyrocketing, and students are reeling under a burden of debt. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. And later in the program, we'll talk about a little music and take a look at the Hawaii Conservatory for Music and the future of that tradition on Delmarva. But first, over the last 5 years, the price of attending a four-year college has skyrocketed by some 27% beyond inflation. That's according to the College Board, and that's not just tuition. So we turn to Diane Allen. She is the Provost and Senior Vice President of Academic Affairs at Salisbury University. And first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's first of all turn, obviously, to what a lot of our listeners are talking about, which, of course, is the future of Delmarva Public Radio. As most know, the license for the two stations, WSCO, WSDL, they are being transferred from Salisbury University Foundation to the university itself. And, of course, the building that we are now broadcasting from, Carruthers Hall, is coming down. Expected, I think, it's early next year, I think is what I hear. So where are we in this process, this transition?
Well, it's a lengthy process. It's been a lengthy process. Currently, the attorneys for the foundation and the attorneys for the university and state are working on the agreement to transfer the licenses, and then all of that has to be approved by FCC. So we're just waiting any day, it may be weeks, it may be just a day or two, that we hear that we have been approved to make the transfer, and then we'll do it.
So what do you see as a future relationship between the station itself and the university as we make this transition from one to the other?
Well, I think we'll add a lot to each other. One of the points of discussion in the past year has been the mission of the institution is primarily academic. And so as we bring the radio stations under the university, working with the faculty and with the radio staff and the manager to see how we might incorporate things at the radio station into the academics and how we can incorporate academics into the radio station. I think there are some there is a faculty group that's working on that. I know that we've been talking about a number of ideas, and I think they run the gamut, where it's maybe helping with your annual drive as volunteers, whether it's doing things in the station to eventually maybe doing news stories on the street. I think the sky is the limit, and I think it's very exciting for both the radio and the university when we think about how enriched the environment is going to be as we work together.
And finally, what do you think that shift is going to mean in terms of what the audience gets, what it's been getting in the past, what do you think it'll get in the future? Because a lot of listeners are saying, well, so what does that mean for me as opposed to, what do you think it means in terms of that relationship?
I think right away it won't change anything.
Yeah.
I think the students will be learning and they'll be in the background, and the audience that's listening won't be able to tell any difference. I think the difference will come from as the students work to work on fundraising plans or work in the annual drive will be more resources for the radio station, and you know that the radio station can use all the resources it can get, and so that will maybe provide additional programming for our audience. But I see in the future as we work, as the station works with the faculty to develop a curriculum, that there might actually be students on the air when there are students that are ready and prepared to do that.
And also, what are the financial challenges here for the station and as the university goes forward?
Well, I think all of those were really clear last year when we were going through all of our discussions. The radio station has not been in the black for a number of years. There is some debt that has to be addressed, and operations need to be funded in some way. The university has in the past provided some resources. I suspect that we will continue to do that, but we really depend on our listenership to help fund the stations, and in fact, this is a public radio station, and you want public support. So the challenges are staffing. You need staffing. How do you pay for that? You need more programming. How do you pay for that? So those are all questions, and there are lots of different solutions to that you know, rise above just money resources. And we'll be looking into all of that.
I want to turn to another cost, which is higher education. I think I mentioned a moment ago we had sometime 27%, at least as projected, beyond inflation over the last 5 years for costs. And I was looking at some dollars and figures and so on, and for, like, universities overall, in constant dollars, okay, just overall universities, in 1980, tuition was something like $8,700. By 2011, it was $21,000. In current dollars, the figure gets even wider, $3,500. Now it's $22,000. And just public institutions, again, constant dollars, 1980, $6,300. In 2011, over $15,000. In current dollars, 1980, it's $2,500. And in 2011, it's $16,000. What accounts for this dramatic increase that we've seen in the cost of higher education?
When you look over those decades, I think you have an increase in instructional cost. The biggest chunk of our money goes to instruction, and that means faculty, that means academic support for students, whether that's the Writing Center or the Center for Student Excellence like we have here at Salisbury. It goes for better laboratory spaces. I mean, if you look at the TETC, look how what a wonderful facility that is, and the Purdue building, so it goes for those kinds of things. And then there's auxiliary. We have beautiful residence halls. Students prefer to live in residence halls like we have here at Salisbury rather than the kind that maybe you and I stayed in when we were students. There are new safety issues. We have to have more safety, more police, more equipment on campus. So I think all of those things contribute. But I think one of the things that we overlook when we talk about the cost of college is that students are choosing, for one reason or another, to stay in college longer. So while I finished in 4 years, and most people of my generation finished in 4 years, it is not unusual for students to finish in 6 years. And that's really changed dramatically. When my children were in college just a decade ago, they finished in 5 years, and I thought that was awful. And in another decade, we're at 6 years. So we're really working on an emphasis with our students coming in this year, with their parents, that we really should look at a four-year experience again rather than stretching it out over 6 years. And so we have to provide some support for students so that they don't make poor choices about courses, they don't change their mind so often. So I think that's sort of a hidden cost that people don't think about. If students are really staying an extra 2 years, and that adds to the overall cost.
Someone suggested as I was looking at this that one of the causes of an increase is just simply that we've emphasized greater access to college. I mean, just historically, colleges were not seen as for everyone. And then we had, of course, the GI Bill, in which there was a flood of folks from the Second World War veterans who took advantage. And suddenly, college was something that was not just simply for the elite, but for the average person who could actually climb up. And as we've moved through the years, we have lots of scholarships and lots more people who are applying for college. Is that a factor in this cost?
Well, I'm guessing that it is. If you add more people, then you add more expense for services provided to them. So if you have more students, then you have to have more faculty. You have to have more assistants. You have to have more housekeeping staff, more dining staff. So if you increase the numbers, then you do increase the cost. And I think one of the things that we do well here at Salisbury University is we don't increase those costs. We don't increase our numbers. We're not growing. That keeps our costs relatively affordable for students.
So, and how many students now attend Salisbury University?
This fall, we're looking at about 8,000 students. Mm-hmm. We're bringing in a new class of around 1,250, which is flat from what it was, same as it was last year. So we're just not growing the number.
So, and do you expect that those numbers to basically remain flat, and at least for the foreseeable future?
I think so, until there's additional funding from the state to bring in more students. Our faculty are teaching as much as they can teach, our services are stretched as thin as they're going to stretch. And to bring in more students without additional funding we would not be able to provide the quality that we are providing. So we're kind of staying flat until things change.
Because one of the things, as a matter of fact, in terms of the increase in tuition, has been suggested that state funding for university and colleges across the country, but also here in Maryland, that has been declining over the years and has forced universities to either raise tuition or find other alternatives. What's the situation with Salisbury University? Has that affected it over the years? Have you seen a declining contribution? And if so, what are the alternatives?
Well, I think that's true. That is true across the nation, that state funding for higher education has declined significantly. So that the balance used to be mostly state funding, subsidized by tuition, subsidized very smallly by gifts and that kind of thing. And now tuition is the big funder. So that certainly is true in Maryland as well. When you look at we're a part of the university system of Maryland, and when you look at across the system, you'll see that Salisbury is funded at the lowest level per student of all the institutions in the system. So we think we don't get our fair share, but I suppose every university would say that. But that is absolutely true, and I think we've been very careful and judicious in passing that on to students only when we have to.
Now, in Maryland, we had, a tuition freeze for about 4 years,
yes,
and it's now inching up. Do you see further increases in tuition as we go down the road?
Oh, I think that's inevitable. I think this year there will be an increase. I'm not sure what that is.
Yeah.
The legislatures have to balance budgets too, and so they give less and less money.
So, and the other issue that, by the way, has come up certainly has been the idea of student loans. I mean, and people have heard me talk about this. When I went to school, four-year school, just like this, it was 1970, and I went to a school actually in California. My costs were $100 for fees, probably comparable $100, maybe $150 for books, and that was it. And when I left college, there was no debt. Now we're talking about people walking away with $30,000, $40,000 or whatever in debt. What about that situation? I mean, when you go to college, one of the things that's really struck me, particularly as I went, when I went to college, is you really better take this seriously because you got a lot of debt, no matter what you do with the degree.
I think that's one of the reasons why we're focusing on a four-year degree rather than a six-year degree for our students, because we're funded so poorly, we have less financial aid to give to our students, which means that then they have to get loans for the difference if they don't have the money to pay it. And so our loan debt among our students is pretty high. So I think that is a concern. I think students don't come to college thinking about the cost so much. Mom and dad try to do that, and mom and dad take out loans. And that's not a good thing for us to be doing. And I think we have to do at the university what we can to support students, either by finding ways to give them more financial aid through donor scholarships, or helping them and supporting them so that they don't have to spend so much time here.
I wanted to also get your reaction to the current student loan legislation. I guess it was signed into law. Basically looking at a 3.9%, I think, rate for subsidized and what they call unsubsidized Stafford loans. Graduate students, I guess, 5.4%, and if parents take out the loan, it's 6.4%. All that's locked in for a year for that loan. But it's all tied to financial markets, but these things are capped for the lowest debt, I think, at 8.2%, and then 10%, I think, for parents. What's your reaction to the kind of legislation that was approved at the federal level, and is it enough?
Well, I think any time you're legislating this, you're in trouble, but... But, you know, I think it really puts parents and students in a spot where they really have to think very carefully about how they finance college. My fear is that we've been through a period where we've had a lot of access to college. And, in fact, the governor and the president want us to increase the number of residents that have degrees. But at the same time, I think people are going to look at the rates and say, you know, we just can't afford that on our budget, and so it will it might mean that some students either delay coming to college or don't come at all.
Do you think there's a possibility with the high cost that we see, and it doesn't look as like it's going to come down anytime soon, that we may eventually really begin to limit the access to higher education for people? I mean, over the last, we talked a moment ago about how there's a lot more students that have access than there were in many, many years past, many more students going to college, but that we could be pricing a lot of kids out of the market.
I think what you're going to see is a trend to different ways of doing college. I think more students are going to start at your two-year institutions because they're cheaper, and then transfer to a four-year. I think more students will go to an online program that they can finish, that they can pace at their own pace and finish quicker. So I think students will look for alternatives, and universities will be looking for ways to be innovative to capture that audience. I think it will be a lot more work on institutions to attract students because of the cost and because of the time factor. And so I think already we've seen an increase in community college attendance.
Finally, in terms of capital projects here, as I mentioned, I think at the beginning of our interview, the building we are in, it will disappear. And some people say, are very sad, by the way, about that, but it has
that.
A rich history. So what are the plans in terms of this space and any other projects you're looking at now on the campus?
Well, of course, the big project that we're all looking at the moment is the new academic commons, which indeed will go on this space. I do understand people's attachment to this building. It was the demonstration school here, and I'm an educator, so I certainly get that attachment to this building. But in reality, this building is not in good shape, and we need the space for our library. Our library is pathetically inadequate for the student body we have. And in fact, the new academic commons will house more than the library. It will house a lot of student supports that we were just talking about, the Writing Center, the Center for Student Achievement, and will be a gathering place, I know, on campus. This is kind of the crossroads of the campus right here by Red Square. We're looking for this building to be demolished over winter break or into the early parts of next year. We first have to build a new tower. There's all of that. There are just a lot of dominoes that have to take place. And then the construction for the new academic commons will take place, and we're hoping to open that building. No, let me change that. We will open that building in the fall of 2016. But that's our deadline. So we're looking forward to that. There are, you know, some other projects that we would love to happen. There's no timeline on those. We have inadequate athletic facilities, so at some point we need to address that. We'd love to have a fine and performing arts center. So those are all of sort of our dreams of things to happen. I know students would like to have more parking. So faculty and staff, yes, as well. So we're moving the tennis courts to the other side of campus, to the east campus, and that area will become a parking lot. So this is a fairly landlocked university, and as we want to do better for our students and provide the best education, we have to have the facilities to support that. So we're always looking to see how we can do that better.
Just briefly, obviously the station is moving away from here. Mm-hmm. I think it's on East Campus. Tell us a little bit about that. What's that going?
Well, we're looking at some temporary quarters. Like I said, there are dominoes. So we're moving the radio station over in the behind the complex that houses the NAB Center and the police station. And then once we get the academic commons built, the NAB Center will move here, so that will open up space in that complex. So, you know, over the next 5 to 6 years, we'll the radio station will have a grand new home.
Okay, we've been talking with Diane Allen. She is the Provost and Senior Vice President of Academic Affairs at Salisbury University. I appreciate you joining us.
Certainly, thank you.
Up next, we'll be talking about a little music, classical music, that is, after this break. And it's no secret that a number of symphonies around the country are facing some hard economic times. And on Delmarva, the Delaware Symphony Orchestra has had its troubles cutting its schedule and revamping its funding. And classical music is still, though, being heard and taught on the peninsula. Of course, one of those places is the Y Conservatory of Music. And in our studio this morning, Amy Morgan, its assistant director, and we welcome you to the program.
Thank you.
First of all, tell me a little bit about the conservatory. How old is it? Okay. And the kinds of things you're doing, first
okay.
of all.
The Y Conservatory of Music has really found a home in the Y Mills in Queenstown area. And officially, I'd say we're in our fifth year, although we've had some programs that have kind of led us to that point that started a little bit before that five-year mark. Mm-hmm. We really aim to offer a good classical music education and performance opportunities to young people.
So what kinds of things would they learn at the conservatory?
Well, in addition to private lessons, we have private piano and voice lessons. We have a number of choral ensembles that are offered to middle school ages, high school ages, and also a number of theater programs.
So, and I think you, I thought I saw where you were emphasizing some operetta, is that right?
That's right.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. The title of that venture was the Y Operetta Workshop, or WOW. And it has had great success over the past 6 years or so, really spending its focus on the operettas of Gilbert and Sullivan. Mm-hmm. And that was offered to students in grades 8 through college. The wonderful thing about it is that it was free to them, free to the participants, and they really were able to experience professional staging and costuming and construction for our scenery. So it's a great experience for them.
So if I'm interested in classical music, play an instrument. What benefit is this? And there are a lot of conservatories. I mean, obviously okay. around yours, I guess is what you said. I think 5 years old. What is special? Do you think about?
Well, I'm thinking particularly for young people these days. It's almost a necessity to have some sort of activity leading into college years. You know, so I think we really do provide a great foundation in classical music for those that are, you know, preparing for auditions, looking into getting into music programs in universities.
Mm-hmm. Is this for folks who are like getting out of high school and getting into college, or what kind of range are we looking
okay.
at?
Okay, well, I could just kind of tell you about
yeah,
some
sure.
of our programs.
Go ahead.
We offer what is called the Y Youth Chorale, which is for grades 4 through 7. And it's really just an early exposure to classical music and, you know, excellent performance and also part singing, which is something that they don't always get at that younger age. Then after that, we really start to get into some good stuff with the group that's called the Y Choral Scholars. And that particularly leads, I think, in preparation to college. And that is for grades, students in grades 8 through 12. And in that program, they are offered a number of performing experiences. They also get voice lessons, and it should be mentioned that it is a scholarship program, so it is also free of charge to them, but they're getting free voice lessons and all of this that goes along with that. That's great for them.
Now, are you looking at these folks as being people who are the children and the students as folks who are going to be looking at doing this professionally? Is that Or what's your feeling about that?
Well, I think.
I'll admit, by the way, that when I was very young, I did play the cello for about four years, but I would never play it again because I was not good at it. But anyway, but what about that?
Well, I think you know, it's great to have, you know, former students go on and to move into that profession. Although we accept that that's not always going to happen. You know. Either way, they're gaining really valuable experience that can help them. You know. Applying for scholarships when they get into college, and the discipline and the community that music provides, you know, is a great experience for them in terms of working with others and communication.
So do you see a benefit, I mean, beyond just simply learning to play music and classical music, do you see a benefit for these students just generally in terms of doing, you know, learning how to play music, that this sort of expands and other things that they might be interested in? I mean, that they may even be unrelated. Do you see this as an intellectual benefit, I guess, sir?
I certainly do. I think that one of the great things about music in general is that it exposes us to different parts of the world, different historical context. So I can think of one student I have in particular who wants to go on and become a history major, and her love of music has, I think, only fueled that further. You know, I think you're getting a lot that you're not going to get in popular media when you're studying classical music.
So what do you make, by the way, I mean, we've had I mentioned at the top that a number of symphonies have been in trouble. Some have filed bankruptcy. We know the Delaware Symphony Orchestra had to revamp, cut back its schedule, apparently didn't have enough assets to declare bankruptcy. On the other hand, we had the Louisville Orchestra. Apparently it did so. Chicago Orchestra, Symphony Orchestra, they report some of their donations have actually gone up. But there are a number of symphonies where you have a situation where they're either in crisis, they got to revamp. What do you make of that going on in this field that you're so involved with?
I think that as a professional musician, often we're relying on the gifts of others in terms of, you know, provisions of salary and benefits and that sort of thing. So I think it's, you know, how do we make this music accessible to everyone and affordable, but yet we still have to maintain relationships with those in the community that are willing to support these types of ventures. I think that's a constant thought in the back of everyone's minds.
And I think I was looking at some stats in which there was something like only like about 2% of professional musicians actually are participate in orchestras, that kind of thing, that are actually classic. So are you, and some have said that there is a decline and interest. It was certainly a problem with attendance at symphonies and so on. How do you see the state of classical music?
I think, again, it's a matter of, I think it depends on where you're located, you know, where we're going to get that kind of reception. I think the biggest, our biggest hope is in education. You know, I think if we put all of our attention towards professional performance, then we're going to lose the support of those that would be coming up behind us and continue to merit that support.
Do you play yourself?
I do, yes.
What do you play?
I play piano. Actually, I graduated here at Salisbury University with a degree in piano performance. And I play organ in church and do a number of other things as well.
So what got you interested in classical music?
I don't know. I just remember starting at a very young age, and honestly, I don't think it was ever a question for me. I remember being in probably elementary school, and I knew that that's something I wanted to pursue. I didn't know what kind of professional avenue I would take, but it never had left my life. So I don't know that it was ever a clear, firm decision so much as it just worked itself out.
So when you play, what is it like? What does it mean to you when you're playing?
Oh, gosh. I think what's exciting is being able to, you know, especially retrieve pieces of music that are hundreds of years old and that they can still be relative to us at this time, still open to fresh interpretation. That excites me to really go back to all of the, you know, classic composers and take on all of their works. And they, you know, to think that they did the same thing in their education, you know, composers such as, you know, Schumann went back and studied J.S. Bach, you know, so I think that's exciting to me.
You know. Did you ever improvise with what they've written?
With what they've written? No, I mean, I've had a bit of improvisational experience, but not on any classical pieces, no.
So, what would you say to people who say there's a certain declining interest in classical music? I mean, we're here, obviously, and we have a classical music station, by the way. We should mention that. But, I mean, but some people say, oh, gee, that's the people, some declining interest.
Yeah, I think that, again, I think it's a matter of making it relevant. I think that, you know, again, we're so oversaturated with popular media and music nowadays that it almost seems there's a barrier sometimes that you have to be of a certain personality type to enjoy classical music. And I think, you know, again, that's why I do think it's important to youth. I think if you're able to make it important to them at a younger age and see that you don't necessarily have to be, I don't know, one person to enjoy classical music. You can enjoy classical music alongside everything else that you are as well.
We've been speaking with Amy Morgan. She is the assistant director for the Y Conservatory of Music. And, of course, earlier we were talking to Diane Allen. She is the provost and senior vice president of academic affairs at Salisbury University. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
Delmarva Today is a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Don Rush is the host. Chris Rank is the executive producer and audio engineer. You can listen to this program again on our website, delmarvapublicradio.net. You can also view our program on PAC-14 television and on demand. Visit PAC-14.org for full details and schedules.